Subject and the guest first. We encourage listening, learning, and freedom of thought. I'm Henrik, and redeyescreations.com is the website where you can find out more about our program, our topics, and the many different ways you can get access to our program and become a regular listener. Barbara Han Klo majored in philosophy at Seattle University, behavioral psychology at the University of Washington, and then began extensive reading and study of Reichian, Freudian, and Jungian psychology. She began her study and practice of astrology in 1969. In 1980, Barbara and her husband, Jerry, co-founded Bear and Company Publishers. In 1982-83, she earned a master's degree in theology and healing. Her thesis compared Jungian psychoanalytical technique and past life regression therapy. Barbara is an international lecturer, workshop teacher, and writer. And today, she returns to Red Eyes Radio to discuss Awakening the Planetary Mind, Catastrophobia, and the Archons. Well, welcome back, Barbara. It's good to talk to you once again, of course. Almost a year ago since we talked last time. How have you been, Barbara?
I'm doing very well, and it's great to be here with you again.
Absolutely. So much to discuss today. There's so much going on, of course. The fear of doomsday is certainly not settling down in any way. It seems collectively humanity and the rest seems to get increasingly paranoid in this world of ours that seems to more and more become kind of uncertain to us as well. And this is natural, I think, when we kind of lose touch, when we have lost our grounding in so many ways that we have. And so much of the mess today, Barbara, I believe, can be traced back to that original catastrophe that you and others have speculated and argued happened around 9,500 BC or about 11,500 years ago or so. And your work on catastrophobia is remarkable. So much included in that work, and I'm very glad now then to see that this topic once again is gaining momentum, and that you've gone back, revised, updated, and expanded on the original book from 2001, and given it a new name called Awakening the Planetary Mind, Beyond the Trauma of the Past to a New Era of Creativity. And of course, you still have that wonderful foreword by J.B. Dallaire in there as well, who wrote Cataclysm together with D.S. Allen as well. Great stuff.
Right, thank you.
So why don't we talk a little bit about some of the background on catastrophobia first, Barbara. I want to talk about what distincts this latest one to the old one, if you will, and what some of the updates you've done. There's so much has been happening in these, 10 years now has gone by, a little bit more.
Yeah.
So give us a rundown on the original catastrophobia theory, if you will, Barbara, first.
Yeah, well, for me, this goes back to the mid-1990s, the original issue that came up. And where it comes from for me is my grandfather was half Cherokee and half Celtic. And he was a carrier of the Cherokee record tradition, which is a tradition that I think is probably 10,000 years old, but certainly my grandfather had amazing knowledge, and he was a great student. And so he told me as a child, I was his initiate, and so from age 3 to age 17 when he died, when I was 17, he told me all about this incredible world cataclysm, and he had a globe in his study, and he showed me with the globe all the different parts of the planet and how they had changed as a result of this. And it went into my mind originally as a child like a great myth, but I very much believed in it. And then when I went to school, what I discovered was most of contemporary science, geology and paleontology, most of contemporary science told another story, a story very different from what my grandfather said. And what they said basically was that we were living in a world of slow and gradual change at the time. So then I was working at Bear & Company as an acquisitions editor, and the book by J.B. Dallaire and D.S. Allen, let's see if I can remember it, because I've got my own titles mixed up in it, but their book on the cat.
That's right.
Yeah, you've got an English title for that, too. I think it's The Earth Nearly Died.
Yes, that's right.
In England, yeah. So that book came to my desk in the English edition, and I'll never forget that day where I sat down and read a story by two scientists from Oxford telling the exact same story that my grandfather had told me as a child. So he told me when I was young that the scientific confirmation for what he was telling me would occur during my lifetime, and that I was to bring this story to the public. So the first thing I did with that issue, of course, is I published the American edition of The Day the Earth Nearly Died. And then the next thing I did is I contacted J.B. Dallaire and D.S. Allen. D.S. Allen, unfortunately, is not with us anymore. He died a few years ago.
Yeah.
I contacted them and I said, look, you've written the scientific story of what happened to us 12,000 years ago. I would like to investigate how this has affected human consciousness, because I'm not a geologist and a scientist. I'm a consciousness researcher. So at that point, I went to work with the two of them. And Catastrophobia came out in 2001. And the main focus of Catastrophobia was, first of all, to describe the cataclysm in detail and all the scientific background behind it, and then to speculate on how that cataclysm has affected us since 9500 BC. In other words, it basically concentrated on 12,000 years of human consciousness. And then we come up to last year, 2011, then or 2012, basically. And then the time came for me to look at not only the cataclysm itself, but really to take a deep look at who we were before the cataclysm. So Awakening the Planetary Mind differs from Catastrophobia in the sense that I'm concentrating a lot more on the last 100,000 years of human consciousness, the regional underworld as defined by Carl Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the shift is in the book.
Let's talk a bit about the aspect of who we were before, and I want to tie into this the bicameral brain or bicameral mind as well of Julian Jaynes. And if you agree with some of his theorists, tell us your approach about that. What is the bicameral brain, Barbara?
Yeah, well, what I was looking for was the sources that went back as far as possible that investigated how our consciousness has been changing as a result of trauma and cataclysm. And lo and behold, one of the books that really caught my attention is The Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind by Julian Jaynes. And have you read it, Henry?
I have a copy. I've skimmed through it. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but very familiar with the concepts and the ideas for sure, yes.
Yeah, and it's a really weird book in the sense that I completely disagree with what the conclusions that Jaynes came to. But what he did was he went way back into early Greek legend, Homer, Hesiod, and Iliad. And he got into a great shift in our species, which occurred about 4,000 years ago. And the shift that occurred basically is apparently we were a very right brain before that time. We had a bicameral mind, which meant that our right brain was active to the point where we could even hear voices in our heads. And as we know, there's some contemporary channels who have that experience also. It's not like the bicameral brain went away 4,000 years ago. It's just that as we became more scientific and as we advanced with left brain development, which of course is something we had to do, then what happened was for a period of about 3,000-4,000 years, the right brain awareness was basically suppressed quite a bit. And so Julian Jaynes, the funny thing about the book is he values that left brain suppression, and he looks back at the period 4,000 years ago when we could hear the gods in our heads, and he basically makes a lot of hay with it, makes a lot of fun with it. But in my case, he's such a researcher that he gave me just incredible detail about what it was like for 3,000-4,000 years ago, the way people's brains used to function and the way they used to think. So one of the ideas in Awakening the Planetary Mind is that now that we've come to the end of the Mayan calendar, and now that full brain consciousness is opening at this time, what's happening is these bicameral skills are starting to come back into people's consciousness. And I think this is actually quite challenging for people.
Absolutely. Reading a bit more about Jaynes' work, Julian Jaynes, the idea that ancient peoples were not conscious, it sounds wrong. I understand what he's saying and what he's coming from that point of view, that we have an idea today about how consciousness, what it is or how it operates and so forth, but this idea too that we're talking about the breakdown of the bicameral mind, it kind of, the theory goes in reverse as well for me when I read through some of the stuff there. It's kind of, in a weird sense, doesn't make sense in any different way.
Yeah, but you have to read it backwards. And I do the same. I do the same thing with the early church fathers, like Tertullian and Irenaeus, where they're the ones who wrote all the commentaries on the Gnostics, against contra Gnostics. And I read all of those backwards. The only way I can get a handle on what people actually didn't think at the time was just to take what they say and just reverse it. And it's exactly the same thing with Julian James.
Let's talk a bit about how we were different back then, do you think? And also, if we can tie in, if you believe that it was, due to the catastrophe that the breakdown of the bicameral mind started, maybe not directly then, but indirectly, that this slowly through this progress, our mind, our psychology and consciousness changed because of the catastrophe. Is that what you believe, Barbara?
Well, I'll put it a little more of a subtle way. I think that this period about 4,000 years ago that James zeroed in on is a point where we were actually waking up. In other words, I think that if you go back 12,000 years ago and you go back to the period after the cataclysm, this is a period of survivalism from about 9500 BC up until about maybe 6000 BC. And if you go back into that period, I think we were in really bad shape. So I actually see this period around 2000 BC as actually an advance forward, where we had recovered enough by 2000 BC so that we were capable of activating left brain skills again. In other words, one of the interesting things about this cataclysm is, of course, scientifically speaking, basically this is an airtight case. I don't care what anybody says. We went through just amazing levels of destruction in this solar system. And it's actually from about 14,000 to 11,500 BC. It's about a period of about 2,000 or 3,000 years. The younger Dryas period, some of these periods that people will recognize by name. And so when we come into who we were after we had gone through this experience, we were really in bad shape. I also have done quite a bit of work doing past life regressions. And I've talked to a fair number of people who have been able to recover memories of the cataclysm and right after the cataclysm. And I actually have done that myself. And you wouldn't believe how it was like the whole electromagnetic field of our brains was just blown sky high. And the recovery has been very, very difficult. But I think it's been a progressive opening. And I think that point 4,000 years ago was actually a breakthrough and not a breakdown. That's where I can take everything Julian James says and I can just reverse it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Exactly. It's very interesting. Well, this was a time, potentially also, Barbara, when a lot of interesting sites around the world were built and so forth. It's almost like, I don't know how to describe it. I've heard other people say that it's almost like at the time we could compare human consciousness more to a consciousness of an insect-like hive, more a collective consciousness, almost to the point where potentially even telepathy, things like that, were achievable or potential. What do you think?
Well, yeah, and I like the word that I like to use is survival consciousness, because in our times, as you know, people have gotten all sorts of ideas about how the world is coming to an end, which I actually think are memories of the past, and I make
right.
that clear in my book. But you see people even in modern times getting into survivalism, where they just limit their options and limit their sense of what the future could be. Their sense of the future is really coming from the past, and it's not coming from the creative now. And so if you get into survival, I think the way to really understand what it was like and why people had a collective, almost beehive mentality, you know, why was it that priests and kings could control people to such a radical degree, and why did we go through those phases? We went through those phases because we were so limited at the time in regarding what we're actually really capable of.
Yeah, so we become dependent and we wanted something to rely on because we didn't trust the rules of nature, so to speak, anymore, because that had abandoned us in a sense. From our perspective, we were the gods looked down on us, as it were, and we had
yeah.
to redeem this in some way. We had to get back on track in some way. So it's almost like we took shelter to authority and those who were in a position to tell us what was going on, the priest class, basically.
Yeah, and of course you and I both know this is basically the national underworld as defined by Carl Kalman, that time acceleration from 3116 BC through 2011, where the priest-king civilization development. And this is a really big deal at this point, Henrik, because the big struggle that people are having now is imagining that they actually could be autonomous. People are so accustomed one way or another to put themselves in a certain niche, in a certain position, and then just accept a salary and just count on the local town government or whatever.
Yeah.
And what's happening around us now is all of those structures, governmental structures, financial structures, social structures, are collapsing. And people need to recover the understanding of what it is to be an autonomous human, which would mean that your full brain capacity is functioning and operating, and then at that point you know exactly how to navigate within the reality that you're inhabiting. You may work in an office building or something like that as a lawyer or something like that, but an autonomous individual is very, very different than someone who is still, you know, feel so controlled by all of those structures and forms. And that's the big crisis right now. That's what people are having to deal with now. That's why I put the book in at this point, by the way, Awakening the Planetary Mind. What happened for me was I worked with Carl Coleman's research and worked with Carl for like 4 or 5 years and, of course, wrote the Mayan Code as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we got closer and closer to the end of the calendar, particularly as we came into late 2010, I was starting to finally develop a very early sense of what we might be like after the calendar ended. And, of course, this would be the issue of what would it be like in November 2011, in December. And so as a result of attempting to imagine what we might be like, then I decided to take catastrophophobia and take it to this next level where I would attempt to describe what we can do, what we are capable of as autonomous human beings. And so that's why the book came out literally came out the day of the end of the calendar, which was wasn't planned.
Right.
But
right.
I tried to target it into the fall of 2011, and ended up coming out right when the calendar ended.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We need to talk a bit about that, of course, where we are now, of course, and why where we're heading, of course. But why are some of these systems collapsing now? Why is the societal structure giving way right now, Barbara?
Well, you know, what we're talking about at this point is something that I've experienced as a complete miracle. And what I'm getting at is Carl Coleman came up with this wacko idea, his analysis of the calendar and the nine underworlds and all that we're very familiar with on the show. And it is the craziest idea that any human being has ever invented, and that I think in the whole history of the human race. And so my issue with it was, it really resonated with me, as you know, when I wrote about it, but my issue was, could this man possibly be right? And the test of that was going to be what happened during 2011. In other words, was it really possible during 2011 that things would accelerate 20 times faster than they had since 1999? And basically, it happened. Last year, the year of 2011 was just one of the most incredible years that I can imagine or remember ever in all of my lifetimes that I've recovered.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so he has come up with a definition of what's going on, but that doesn't answer all the questions about who are we and what are we going to do in the middle of these energetic fields. That's my part of it.
Right, because we're still suffering, if you will, then from a lot of things that are originating in the national cycle that you mentioned before. This hasn't ended in that sense. The majority of people are still dependent, and they are not. They haven't awakened to the planetary mind. So what's going on with that? When is this going to spread far and wide? Is this for a few individuals? What's going on there, Barbara?
Well, I think regarding the idea that he came up with, I think it's going to be kind of like harmonic convergence. I think 10 years from now, there probably won't be anybody who doesn't look at 2011 that way. That's kind of the way these things happen. You don't understand what happened until after it's over with. So regarding What seems to be happening, what I'm focusing on mostly, is just events that are giving me information about what actually might be happening. And I can come up with a bunch of them, but the one that I think is the most astonishing is the issues over the testing and discovery of the Higgs boson particle at CERN, and also the mathematical calculations for superstring theory have now been accomplished. And both of these discoveries were announced in early December, which is, of course, about 5-6 weeks after the calendar ended.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it really is amazing. And the reason this caught my eye as much as it has is that I'm the author of Alchemy of Nine Dimensions. And I'm my other area of my research has to do with nine dimensions of consciousness. And my theory in Alchemy of Nine Dimensions is based on superstring theory. And then I had been saying for 10 or 15 years that the next leap in human consciousness was going to come because of the acceptance of superstring theory as being a description of our reality. And just to put this in a really simple way, for the last 100 years, we've mainly been living in terms of quantum mechanics, and we have all kinds of incredible technological devices because of quantum mechanics. And if we were to be living in a world where the technology that we're dealing with was or is based on superstring theory, then what would happen is the devices and technology that we live with would be based on multidimensional consciousness, which is just such a critical leap forward. So because I had been saying that this would be discovered at the end of the Mayan calendar, when it actually happened, I was just simply in a state of utter shock. People who had heard me say that at lectures just were contacting me and saying, we can't believe that you could have realized that was going to happen. And so, Henrik, I think what has happened is I think that the multidimensional fields of human consciousness, which I think were completely open before the cataclysm. See, there's this other issue of, like, who were we before we got got our heads knocked off, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So I think this discovery of the first of all, in terms of superstring theory, the mathematical calculations have now been accomplished with a large computer. And then also the Higgs boson particle has definitely been spotted by CERN. It's just that they're trying to, you know, they're really trying to define exactly what's happening with that. So I don't know how long it's going to take them to realize what they've discovered and what they're going to do with it, but I can't ignore the fact that it came right at the end of the calendar. I really think that this is the next step. And so I feel in a privileged position, and I don't want this to sound like ego because it's just not my thing at all, but Alchemy of Nine Dimensions really does describe what we would be capable of if we were really truly multidimensional human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of, so I'm kind of dealing with not only describing the history and the geology and all that stuff regarding what's been happening with us, but also I actually do have some methods and techniques for how to handle the new level of awareness that seems to be arriving now.
Barbara, a lot of people are, of course, waiting for something, in some cases physical, concerning all this 2012 stuff. And yes, of course, we have the steel that we mentioned before with you. We have the debate of 2011 Carl's date versus, you know, the upcoming one here in December. But basically what you're saying is that we have maybe planted the seeds of the knowledge, the realization, in a sense, but we haven't yet been able to enjoy the fruits of sorts, meaning that the opportunities for these things actually are here now, but they're not implemented on a bigger scale yet. Is that correct?
Well, except that I'm seeing within individuals, I'm seeing tremendous breakthroughs going on with individuals. And then in terms of this more collective level, like things that might come to us by means of science, of course, that's something that's going to unfold over time. But the fact that the discovery that we need in order to take that leap has already occurred, that's extremely significant. And then the issue is what's going on with people individually. And what I'm noticing, first of all, I've been out teaching since the calendar ended, so I've got a way of kind of gauging whether anything happened.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the students are reporting that 2011 was one just absolutely the most traumatic year of their life in terms of just stress and constant just push. Everybody was just really reeling under the pressure. And then people are reporting to me that when we get into December and January, people are saying that they're feeling a peacefulness and a calmness coming in for them. And most importantly, people are reporting very high degrees of creativity as long as they don't try to control everything. If they're able to let go of, I got to do this now, I got to do that now, and just take in what's actually coming in the field, people are having some really astonishing experiences. And this is what I would expect to see if there's a reorganization of the very fields of consciousness on the planet. You would expect to see people, you know, responding that way.
Hmm. Interesting. Has the acceleration that Carl describes in his work stopped, or is it still going? It's increasing. How do you see this panning out?
And this is a really complicated question, because this is one that Carl, I'm at this point, Carl and I are buddies, but Carl's going his way and he's going mine, and I'm going mine, which is,
right.
Which is, of course, totally appropriate. So he's really exploring how these waves are operating at this point, and I know we'll be hearing from him in a book and also in terms of interviews. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm just watching events. Now, I'm not, Astroflash ended at the end of the calendar, so I'm not cataloging the events by means of the new moons anymore. I'm just watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best example of the shift in the energy field is in the all of the issues around the potential default of Greece and what's going on in the Eurozone. And so what happened as soon as the calendar ended, if you recall last year, all anybody talked about was Greece is going to default, there's going to be a disaster, Portugal's going to fall apart. You remember all that stuff. It was endless crap going on, although there were events to support the fears. And then suddenly, right after the end of the calendar in late November and early December, the Europeans basically created a system that's kind of similar to the Federal Reserve in the United States. And basically what happened is they just started printing money. And I don't know what the consequences of that are going to be ultimately, because money is a funny thing. You know, money is actually an etheric thing, and it doesn't always add up to what people think it adds up to. But what has happened, I think, for most people in Europe is they have, they are feeling at this point like everything isn't on the verge of imminent collapse all the time.
Right.
Just a quick
question there, because I'm trying to connect these dots. Are you talking about the European Stability Mechanism, the ESM, that they created? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yes. I don't have all the terminology.
Right. No, I just wanted to make sure, because, I mean, that's exactly in terms of how demonic the Federal Reserve is.
Yeah,
this is definitely in comparison, you know, because this is debt-based slavery. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, and when they did it, of course, I was watching especially carefully because of the end of the calendar. And what happened at that point was a lot of people who were speculating on bonds and speculating in various areas in the markets basically got really screwed because they just changed all the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's the funny thing about money. Money is a really funny thing in terms of, like, we're, how much of it is there really, and what happens when when there's too much debt? Just suddenly people start making deals and all the rules of the game change,
yeah.
And that's basically what happened. So I think that's a very good example. And then in the political realm in general, I was really worried about Israel attacking Iran for a long, long time. And I felt like if it didn't happen by the end of the calendar, it probably wouldn't. And at this point, I think it won't happen.
Really?
And
okay.
I think it won't happen
every day. But how do you see this not escalating further, Barbara?
Well, Fareed Zakaria did a really interesting thing on Sunday. I don't know if you ever watch him. He's on CNN, and he's a really great interviewer. And he ran a bunch of clips of things that were being said in the world 50, 60 years ago when we had the Cold War between the Americans and the Soviet Union. And he ran a whole bunch of clips of the Americans threatening the Russians and all that stuff. And then he ran them side by side with the kind of threats that you're hearing now. And what happened, of course, during the Cold War is everybody screamed, yelled, and threatened each other, but they didn't actually attack. And he made a pretty strong case for the idea that that's what's going on now. In other words, that it's not worth it really to be that worried about all the blustering. And you know, another thing, let's get back to catastrophobia and then awakening the planetary mind for a minute here. The basic idea of these two books is that we have a huge data bank in our brains of past cataclysm that we have not processed at all. And so then what happens is we have kind of a free-floating anxiety complex that's floating all over the place looking for something to be afraid of. And that's what I'm really after. That's what my work is really all about, is identifying that free-floating anxiety and opening our consciousness to the levels of strength that we're actually really capable of. So it doesn't do you much good to worry all the time about what the Israelis are going to do to Iran.
Not that
I'm not paying attention.
No, but it's a very important point, a very good point. Rumors of war, economic collapse, all these things are, after all, echoes of catastrophe, and the question is how much we, both consciously and the people who pull the strings, are manifesting these events for people who keep to keep them busy, to keep them occupied, to keep them worried. There's a number of motives why they would want to do this, but also, Barbara, even on a subconscious level, by those who will call the shots, so to speak, on the geopolitical scene. Anyway, that they also, you know, manifest these things, because this is a way for us to try to maybe, I don't know, try to deal with some of the trauma. It's almost like, an abusive alcoholic parent. You know, you have a partner who then seeks up another alcoholic to try to, in some weird kind of way, understand and deconstruct their parental figure, you know. And in the same way, maybe we're creating scenarios of close catastrophe so that we can in some way, I don't know, understand it, analyze it more on a subconscious level, of course. What do you think, Barbara?
Yeah, well, what we know from psychology and advanced neuroanalysis and all this is the brain will just spin around and around something that hasn't been identified. If it's lurking in there, such as early childhood abuse or something like that, people will always be kind of floating on the surface of that trauma and be very dysfunctional in their current lives. And where it gets really fascinating to me is I've spent so much time thinking about this survival period, because if we go back to 9,000 to 6,000 BC, there's almost no remnants on the planet. We finally found some things like Kotlahuyuk and Göbekli Tepe, but it's amazing how little we have to see going back to that period, because there was so much destruction. And so one of the things that I think about a lot is that one of the things that's extremely difficult to understand about the modern human is some of the incredibly atavistic crimes that we see, where people just commit murders and imprison people and all that and torture other human beings to a degree that is just, you know, we look at it and we go, this is incomprehensible. Well, if you go deep into that survival mentality, when people had to abuse even their own children, even sexually, and produce other children, some of this stuff shows up in the Bible, doesn't it? And so I think that we're at this, that's why I use the term awakening the planetary mind. As all this memory awakens and as all this consciousness awakens, it's logical that we would see some of the truly bizarre behavior that we're witnessing. I'm sure you do the same thing. I just look at, you know, a crime that has been committed and I just can't believe it.
Yeah.
And the only way I can identify it is to look at it from this point of view.
And this I apply to our world leaders as well. Barbara, there's psychotic, psychopathic behavior, and it's all kind of coming out into the open now as well. Do you think that that's part of the times that we're in, the shifting, changing of consciousness, that things in terms of how you maybe were able to keep things hidden before is not as effective anymore for those same reasons? People are, of course, on one level more conscious, a few of us anyway, but there might be other things that goes on there as well.
Yeah, and this is a very positive process. I'm working on a novel right now, as I told you, and one of the things I'm really going after is the issue of priestly sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And when we look at a situation like that, like the number of children who have been abused and the number of priests who have become abusers. What we see at this point is we see the truth coming out. And again, as people read stories of what actually happened to people, you're stunned and you can't believe it and all that. But number one, it does happen. I think that when we look at situations like that, I think that people are in their survival mind, people who commit these acts, and I don't even necessarily think that they really know what they're doing when they're doing it, as far as I can see with crimes. But the important thing for us at this point is, as difficult as it is to face some of this stuff, now that the truth is coming out, it's not going to be possible for people to act like this anymore. And so we're at this point, you know, of facing really, really hard truths, but we're on the edge of being able to change the type of behavior that the humans are going to be getting away with.
Yeah.
And this is all really relevant. That's why I got into these databanks so deeply, because, boy, this is important stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not written about very often either, because nobody wants to talk about it. Like when Catastrophobia came out, it was one of those books that sold a 1,000 copies more every year, like the first year two, the next year three, and so on and so forth, because there was a wave of energy of people getting themselves to the point where they could even think about it, you know?
Yeah.
And yet, boy, this truth is coming out, and as hard as it is to face, boy, I welcome every inch of it, you know?
Yeah. No, it's true. I think the initial, as always, initial reaction is to resent it before you kind of build up the courage to look at it, you know, coherently in one sense. And by the way, I also wanted to mention that point that you brought up about the fact that they might not be even aware of what they're doing. In that sense, again, we're back to that idea that they're not conscious. They don't have the same level of consciousness. And there is an interesting study on psychopaths on the fact that they might actually be brain damaged in that sense. There was a report last year, December, from the Scientific American that talked about this, that they've studied you know, the different components of the brain and basically discovered that there's other stuff going on there. So are they really consciousness? Can we even classify them as regular human beings? I mean, there's a number of questions that arise consequently to this.
I think that they aren't normal human beings. I think even they would be the first ones to admit it. But since they're the way they are, they don't know what to do about that, of course. And first of all, it wouldn't it be great if we had some neuroscientists studying what goes on in the brain when people have repressed trauma?
Yeah.
And this is, we're on the verge of that, because another issue we have going on in our current world is the number of soldiers returning from war around the planet, especially in the United States. People who have severely severe issues with brain damage and post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right, the depression, they kill themselves. It's horrendous what goes on there, for sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is very, very sad, and you can't blame them, because they got sent over there because the only way you get a job in America is to volunteer for the military.
Well, there's always an option. That's my point.
No, I agree with you, because of course nothing's going to stop unless people refuse.
No,
to go
exactly.
Fight.
I mean, this support the troops. The only way I would apply that to is bring them back home to their respective countries. Then that's the only point.
Yeah. We're in complete agreement on that, but what is shocking about the States is that for a lot of young 17, 18, 19-year-old young men who want to go out and get a job, they take that option because that's the only job they can get. But this is ending. This is another issue. Speaking of the end of the calendar, wasn't it interesting that right after the calendar ended, suddenly all the troops are home from Iraq? Now, the contractors are not home.
No, there's a lot of people not home from there. Blackwater?
But,
nope.
Yeah, but I would say that you could make a case for the idea that there may have been a turnaround with war. Now, we'll see about that.
Mm-hmm.
But the shift in people leaving the fields of war was so dramatic right at the end of the calendar that I'm actually very hopeful about that.
Well, see, Barbara, this is a very interesting point, because what I see, and in a certain, in the symbolic sense, I agree with you, but I also see the strategy have changed. For instance, we've seen the same outcome basically happening in Libya, but they did it in a totally different way, which now is under the guise of humanitarian aid, and we got to help these people. It's happening right now in Syria and other, you know, countries as well. So it's a potentiality that they are in some way maybe aware of the fact that many people would not accept another war, so they have to they've upped the ante in terms of how they pulled this, you know, the rug under our feet, basically. And this is the new strategy. That's all I see, Barbara.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to argue with you about that in terms of what the global elite is up to. But if the strategies change and the way that the ends are accomplished, then you're going to have less and less individuals all the time who get caught up, you know, like think of the trench warfare during World War I and stuff like that.
Right.
And I guess I'm enough of an optimist to feel that if enough individuals have a different choice in life, that ultimately things are actually changing. But I'm not going to argue with you about what the global elite is up to.
No.
They're going to get away with it.
I agree.
If they can.
It doesn't mean that things are not moving or not happening, because I think consequently they've discovered that you know, something needs to be done. They need to change their strategy. And the only reason I bring this up and mention this is because we need to keep up with it. We can't just settle down and say, oh, look, everything is over, war is over, it's not happening anymore. But it actually is, but just it comes in a different shape and form, you know. So I believe,
yeah,
I'm positive in that sense as well, but we need to keep up the work, if you will, of detailing this, exposing this, of looking at it, of getting informed about these issues, so we understand that we're not just you know, kind of sucking up the mainstream media and their garbage basically about this,
no,
because
I
it's not true.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you, but I put it to you this way. Another change that seems to have come at the end of the calendar. Now the issue of 2011, you have to ask yourself, what was the acceleration? Well, as far as I can tell, having watched it all last year, it was the ability of people to use social media in order to change their society. And in other words, the galactic underworld, 1999 plus, was the acceleration of technology, Blackberries, and all that stuff. But the significant change in 2011 was the number of people who discovered that they could change their reality by using social media. And I think you would probably agree with that.
It's definitely changed, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm
not saying I know what it's going to create, but
right,
for example, the next challenge regarding what the global elite is up to is that all citizens of all countries on our planet have to refuse to allow drone warfare.
Yeah, that's the next step.
Okay.
You're right. Yeah.
And when you think about something like drone, because that's all they're trying to do now, let's not send the guys over there, let's just send the drones over there. Not like we don't know what they're doing. But the point would be, the only thing that's going to stop that is the opinion of taxpayers and citizens in every country in the world who refuse to allow that. You see what I mean? So
yes,
that's the kind of way that I think change is probably going to go.
You're right. Again, over 58% of Americans' taxpayer money goes to fund the war.
That's right.
So that should say something right there. I know I don't want to give all the credit to the elite and the globalists either, but they're very slick in their strategies, and we have to keep up on this, and we can't settle down. And so, same thing, you know, happens with social media. I think everything has, Barbara, in our world, in a certain extent, it is polarized. It can be used for really good things or also for really nefarious bad things. Data mining, the way that human beings now are being studied and tracked online because of social media, is the darker side of the issue of this as well. So we need to, you know, be aware of them both here, I think.
Yes, I agree.
So why don't we talk a bit about how we can deal and heal from some of the catastrophes, some of the trauma associated with this as well, since most people are, you know, in a state of mind of being fearful. They you know, how do we snap out of this? Is this ever going to fix itself? What can we do to heal, Barbara?
Well, I think we are doing it. As I've watched, of course, the original book came out in 2001, and I've seen a tremendous improvement in the degree to which people are dealing with seeing the darker side and seeing that it's just getting better every year, as far as I'm concerned, which I think is going to have a positive outcome ultimately. But what my grandfather said, and what I've stuck to all the way through this whole thing, is he said that until people hear the story, they're not going to be able to do anything. In other words, the thing that enables people to take on their full intelligence and their full capability is actually understanding their story. And that's, of course, where these books are coming in terms of helping us remember not only what happened to us, but the other issue here is, who were we before this whole thing happened?
And I really
think, as I look at reality around myself, I just think that this is happening. And I think the biggest issue is for people to understand what's happening. That's the biggest confusion. Don't you find when you talk to people, it's like there's just a deep sense right now of not being able to imagine what the future could possibly be and not really being able to imagine how they are part of a future that is arriving, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's exactly like what I said before. We notice that it's very uncertain times. No one knows what's going on. And at the same time, if people don't have the understanding and the in that sense, the balls to create their own destiny, to create their own future, they again are going to fall prey for those who seek to dominate and control us, Barbara. And that's why this is so important, to understand the components of what a human being is, what we're capable of, what we are tapped into when it comes to the larger reality of the fields and the changing energies as well. Because if we get to that point, I think true independence might be actually achievable and possible. But as soon as people are in a very clouded state, as you said, they're very confused about what is going on, they don't even know how they're going to make it to the next day, then it's very difficult to look ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, right, I agree. But you know, let's look at it from the point of view of the perennial wisdom. Remember that term, the whole issue of the great knowledge of the past, which was basically a destruction started on our planet regarding the ancient wisdom about 2,500 years ago. We go back to 500 BC up through 200 AD or whatever, and we start seeing, for instance, the destruction of the Alexandrian Library and stuff like that. So maybe we can shift a little bit over to the Gnostics, because I think the Gnostics are the real geniuses in terms of understanding how evil actually works in our world and how evil actually comes into our reality. And what we see 2,000 years ago with the rise of the Catholic Church is we see an intentional, consistent suppression of the story. In other words, we have like a 2,500 year suppression of the ancient wisdom. And if we go back to 2,500 years ago, we have a situation on the planet where people did know the story. We get this from Plato, we get this from a lot of ancient sources.
Yeah.
And then there was suppression on the story. And the reason that the truth has been suppressed is because you can't control people if they know the truth. So from my perspective, see, another thing I do is I like to watch people in terms of how old they are. Like, I like to look at, like, what does a 50-year-old know, what does a 40-year-old know, and so on down to 5, 10, 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And as I go down with people in age, down to age 40, down to age 30, I find they know more and more all the time. Now, that is, those are the ones who are educating themselves. There's a whole huge, there's always a huge mass of people who just don't pay attention to anything, they just don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look at the educated people and the people attempting to figure out what's going on, it's easier for me to have a conversation. A 25-year-old is more likely to have read my references in my books than a 50-year-old is.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a progressive awakening. And speaking of the Gnostics, we can certainly bring John Lash into the conversation. John Lash has brought through such a profound breakthrough regarding the activity of the archons on this planet. And this, of course, fits right into my own research in terms of the cataclysm, because I actually think that the archons were created during the cataclysm.
How detailed that? That's very interesting.
Well, I'll detail it exactly. If you go back into the descriptions of the cataclysm that we have, the best one is the Enuma Elish, which is Sumerian records. And if you read all of these early sources describing the cataclysm, it's all about these great titans fighting in the sky. It's about the description of various bodies and the destruction of various bodies in the sky. And I think that what happened is I think that when the cataclysm occurred and damaged our solar system, I think that's when evil came into the world. And I can see that especially by reading the ancient sources. And then once that happened, then these ancient sources like the Enuma Elish or Hesiod or Plato's story of the past, what happens is the planets turn into archetypes. Instead of, you know, Mars being just Mars, Mars is also the planet of war. And what happens is archetypal energy gets attached to the bodies in the solar system. And, of course, one of the bodies that was in the solar system is now the asteroid belt, because what happened during the cataclysm is a planet that was in the area of the asteroid belt was actually destroyed. So we actually have the issue of a part of our whole system actually being completely destroyed,
yeah,
which has had a great effect on our psyche. So I think at that point, I think there was such a disturbance in this system that it was possible for the archons to be created. What I mean by that specifically is that people went into such fear in their consciousness that evil was actually created in the minds of the inhabitants of the earth.
Uh-huh. That's what I wanted to get to.
See what I'm saying?
Interesting.
Yeah, that's
yes.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is something I think a lot of us are really chewing on right now, because the question is, how did evil come into the world? How did we fall? And, of course, I'm working with the idea that the cataclysm is what actually happened, but then human beings drew drew the conclusions at a psychological level, which is what you would expect them to do. And so then where it gets really interesting is, by the way, Henrik, one of the more interesting things about this research for me has been that I have been amazed by how hard the global elite tries to cover up this story. And when I first ran into that with astronomers and physicists and all that, I just thought, well, there's something wrong with these people. They can't see the data right in front of their very noses, mm-hmm, in terms of what actually happened here. But the more I watched people, the more I realized that, number one, they were not looking at what was right in front of their faces because they were afraid of it themselves. That's one defense for them, and I can accept that as a defense.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But there's another whole huge segment of the global elite that knows that if people don't have their story, and if they don't know what really happened, they're going to continue to be psychologically deranged, and you can control them.
Hmm. Very interesting.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. So the archons, do they just plague our subconscious in a sense? Or do they exist, if you will, and kind of poetically, you know, in our shadow world, or is it? More than that, is it actually that through the fear state that humanity was in at the time, we, through the concept of the tulpa and all this thought forms, we actually literally created something in the physical realm that now has become known as the archons, Barbara?
I don't know the answer to that totally. And it's kind of like having a discussion with somebody about David Icke and who are the reptilians, if you know what I mean.
Right.
It's very difficult to define exactly who these beings are and or how they actually got there. And so I tend to be very comfortable with first of all, I think it's important to admit that they're a real force and to recognize their behavior in the world. I think that nothing's going to change unless we recognize the truth about what's really going on. And then if they are a psychological construct of some sort that just comes from fear, and after all, it is possible that human consciousness can do that, then they're going to change and maybe ultimately disappear if people change the way their minds operate, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
But this is, as far as I'm concerned, a really, really tough question. And I actually had a little talk with David Icke about it once, where I just said to him, in my system, I'm working with 9 dimensions. And for me, the archons are in the 4th dimension, not in the 3rd dimension. The 3rd dimension is where we live. It's linear space and time.
Hmm.
And the 4th dimension is the archetypal realm. And so one of the interesting things John Lash pointed out in one of his books was he had some really interesting instructions coming from the Gnostics, where the Gnostics actually gave some teachings out about what to do if an archon appeared.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
I don't know if you noticed that stuff, but I really was fascinated by that stuff, because I've had the archons appear a couple of times, and I actually did exactly what John Lash said the Gnostics said you should do with it, in dealing with an appearance. And they went away. And so in my universe, this means that they're 4th dimensional, but they have the ability to come into our dimension. And I certainly think that they do, because we see so much evidence for it. So it's a tricky question because, like William Irwin Thompson told me one day that these questions have to do with misplaced concreteness, which I just loved. We were talking about people having problems with visitations from extraterrestrials. And William Irwin Thompson just said this is just misplaced concreteness. They're not really solid and they're not really there, but they definitely can affect you. You see what I mean about that subtle edge?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's where this edge is. I think it's between the third and fourth dimension. And that's why I like my work in alchemy a lot regarding how to handle third dimension and how to handle the fourth dimension. We have a lot of choice about whether the fourth dimension is going to affect us or not.
Okay, I have two questions here for you then. First of all, did you then bring these out, the Archons, when you had your encounter? Did they come to you, so to speak, then, because something that you did? Did you allow them in? And second, can you give us some of those clues on what to do if we encounter one ourselves?
You're right. Yeah, I was working on Heart of the Christos, a book I wrote a long time ago, and I was in my study out in New Mexico. And a bunch of those Sumerian chicken beings appeared on the roof. They really did. You know those ones who have chicken feet and chicken beaks and wings? You know those guys?
Yeah, from
the Babylonians.
The
tablets. The Babylonians did a lot of versions of those guys, the chicken gods.
Mm-hmm.
And they were stomping on my roof. And I literally could hear them, and I could see them, and I could feel them. And at the point that they appeared, I was busy working on a section of the book that had to do with revealing some major secrets about how people are controlled. And I don't remember what it was at this point, but I remember it was some sort of initiation back in Atlantis or something like that. And what happened was I had conjured up a complete field of energy that had to do with breaking that code. I was opening a secret that had been hidden for thousands of years. So of course they showed up. And that was their territory, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, what I did with them was I just said, look, you guys, I really respect you, and furthermore, you're magnificent, and you look great, but you're not going to tell me what to do today. Forget it. I just said, I'll sit here all day and all night if I have to, and finally you'll go away, because you'll be bored with it. And they did.
So, interesting. So are they must be driven, then, in one sense, by the, the non-local field. They have a... And intelligence and understanding, a perception of their own, and when something is going on, administratively almost, that they feel it could be a key to, that is going to unlock a door, that is going to be to a disadvantage for them, that's when they potentially interfere, show up, do something, correct?
Yeah, and so that's a very good way to put it, because the fourth dimension functions by means of the laws of quantum mechanics. So it's functioning by means of non-local fields and probabilities and stuff like that. And the fourth dimension can be accessed in the third dimension, as we well know by all the devices that we're working with. So that's a very good way to describe how this is functioning, as far as I can tell. But the Gnostics felt that people should understand how these fields operate, and they should receive instruction as to how to deal with those fields. And for me, this really comes from my childhood training, Native American training, which is how to stay in your integrity in the third dimension, how to be located right where you are right now and not be confused about being in any other kind of place. And Native American teaching has to do with teaching you that your power lies in your ability to be present in your current reality and to be clear about that. And then, as you know, with a lot of Native teachings, you can really travel into the fourth dimension and the higher dimensions as long as you're located at your altar in this dimension.
Mm-hmm. So also, Barbara, their presence could be a kind of a clue that we're on the right path, in a sense.
Yeah. And so I've just, it's another thing, is fear is such a big issue, Henrik. Like, when something like that happens, I don't go into fear. Because fear to me is the edge of my freedom. You know, if I go into fear, I lose my freedom. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that's an edge that I maintain very carefully, because I notice as long as I don't go into fear, I do have a lot of freedom.
Yeah, that's a good point. Something we should all
keep
in mind. And of course, because it's very, we lose our ability to be rational in most cases, meaning we don't make good judgments, we don't really decide for ourselves, something else takes over, subconsciously. Yeah. And what if even those components, Barbara, can be influenced, they can be, you know, we can be nudged, if you will, in different directions when we're in this state, because after all, that's what it is. It's a different state of being, a different consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost anything can happen. And I've had a couple of good friends get thrown into prison during the last 10 years, and I've been, of course, corresponding with both of them very regularly. And it's just amazing to watch that point when a person's fear will even create a reality where they end up in prison. And this includes the fact that one of them really, neither one of them really should be there at all. But there's something going on with the way they create their reality that they ended up at that place.
Hmm. Interesting.
So it's like, yeah.
So that means I see what you mean. It's almost like then we literally we create the reality we're in, and if we end up in a bad feedback loop of fear and paranoia or self, we could, if we don't watch ourselves, we can end up in a really bad situation, basically. So how do we take control, if you will, then, of ourselves, if we even at that point have the ability to understand that we're kind of spiraling down away into a bad place? How do we prevent that, if you will?
That's what all my teachings in alchemy are all about. That's why I actually wrote the book. And it has to do with really learning how to inhabit the third dimension. And the third dimension is our planet and our world. And as you know, we're at an incredible, as far as I'm concerned, turning point right now, where we're taking our world back from the global elite. And the global elite are really operating in the fourth dimension. They're masters at dealing with fourth dimensional forces to their own advantage. And if, you know, like, for example, I've been an astrologer my whole life. And of course, from the beginning, people are treating me like I was an idiot. So what the global elite does is the global elite uses astrology all over the place to run their programs.
And then
they run disinformation programs debunking programs, where they make anybody who's an astrologer or a psychic into a fool, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so we're in, the reason alchemy is such an important work is alchemy literally gives the mastery codes for how to work with the different dimensions. And there's nothing new, by the way, there's nothing new about it. I had a past life in 1500 BC in the Heliopolitan mystery schools in Egypt. And in the Heliopolitan mystery schools, from about maybe 3000 BC to about 1200 BC, they had all of this information, and Egyptian society was maintained on an extremely high level by means of working with these levels of consciousness. And so what I'm really teaching is how to be fully present in the third dimension, fully conscious, and then how to consciously access these other levels. For example, if you we can look at the fourth dimension from many, many points of view. We don't just have to see it as an evil field of archons that are attempting to control everything. The fourth dimension also has to do with human creativity and the ability to work with archetypal consciousness. And so in really healthy societies, people are well located in the third dimension. And when I say well located, I mean they have what they need, and they have a way of providing for themselves so that they have some autonomy. And then they are free to explore these other levels of consciousness. And so regarding the fourth dimension, in a healthy society, such as I found in Bali 20 years ago, I don't know how it is now, but I was really intrigued by Bali. Because they were using the fourth dimension the way it should be used, which is a field of dark and light creative forces. And so you have all these wonderful dramas with dragons and angels, because people need to play in the fourth dimension. They need to play with those expanded levels of consciousness, and they need to deal with their own inner issues with the dark and the light by playing with it creatively.
Interesting. Just a quick note there on what you said before about astrology. J.P. Morgan allegedly said, I don't know if the quote is true or not, but the idea is true nonetheless. He said, millionaires don't use astrology. Billionaires do. I mentioned that a few times before, but it's a good one. It's kind of a clue of what's going on there, by the way. But you're also saying, Barbara, in a sense, that we need to you know, focus primarily on the positive, to stay out of the negative, but we shouldn't be afraid at the same time, obviously, to do the legwork, if you will, to actively avoid and also getting rid of the negative components in our life. It needs to be, again, we need to have these both aspects going at the same time. We can't exclude one or the other, because then we miss the whole picture, correct?
Yeah. And then there's another issue here altogether is, what about those higher dimensions? See, is the fourth dimension is just simply the fourth dimension, but there's 9 or 10 dimensions. And when we get into the higher dimensions, like, for example, the sixth dimension is just about my favorite one, because the sixth dimension is the field of geometrical forms. And so on our planet, the sixth dimension, we have access to it through ley lines and vortexes and sacred sites. And so if we go back 5,000 years ago, we'll find a very, very highly developed technology. In fact, if you go back 15,000 years ago is when you see really highly developed levels of human consciousness regarding the sixth dimension. And when the sixth dimension is open to people, then they actually can feel the ley lines and the vortexes. They actually can feel the opening potential in a temple. Like when a person has a sixth dimension open, they can go to a sacred site like the Great Pyramid or like Knossos or something like that in Crete. And they actually can get in touch with these very, very, very high levels of consciousness. And the question is, like, what are those levels of consciousness? Well, when you go into the sixth dimension, you are into the realm of ideal forms. It's actually very Platonic. And what exists in the sixth dimension is an ideal form of Henrik. There's an ideal Henrik in the sixth dimension, and that ideal Henrik knows when he should be doing yoga and knows when he should be taking a walk and knows which supplements he should be using and
who
what he should be eating. This is the ideal Henrik. But what's amazing is that by the way, a lot of body workers these days are working with connecting the sixth dimension to the third dimension. It's just that they don't always know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They've been trained how to do it, but they don't really know what they're doing. And what goes on in the sixth dimension is literally an ideal world. And there are even worlds above that that are even higher than that. And the amazing thing about these dimensions is as soon as you incarnate and born on the planet Earth, you have the ability and the right to access those levels of consciousness. And what happens with that is, if people do it and when people do it, our world transforms. The third dimension. And a dear friend of mine for many, many years was John Michel. I don't know if you know John Michel's work.
Well, I do.
New View over Atlantis. But John and I were great buddies. And John and I used to teach together in England at the sacred sites, and I did crop circle research with him and all that. And John Michel just simply lived in the sixth dimension. He was the most sixth dimensional person that I have ever met in my life. And he was a complete mystic, and all that he could see was just beauty around himself and geometry and color. And you can see it in some of the paintings that he's done and some of the things he's written. And John, to me, was a person who was way, way ahead of his time, and I think he's going to be like a prototype of human beings in the future, because he literally lived in this dimension totally in touch with those ideal realms of consciousness. And we can all do that.
Yeah, he was an excellent geometrician, kind of like Bucky Fuller a little bit, kind of same.
Yeah, he was really, because he was practicing with the geometry all the time, drawing and working with it, he just embodied it. That's what happened for him. And then the seventh dimension is sound. And so a lot of people these days are working with sound healing. They're working with crystal bowls and tuning forks and different things. And what they're doing is they're tuning into that dimension that actually creates form on the planet. The sound creates the geometry, and then it becomes form in the third dimension. And so what I'm really saying, Henrik, is I've said this for years, but now it's actually happened. Those fields are open at this point, and I detect a significant difference in people. But the issue for people is that what they're experiencing is so intense that they can't verbalize it, they can't figure out how it fits into the future. And more what I'm seeing people doing is I'm seeing people just surrendering and just living, and that's exactly what we've got to do now.
All right, very good. That's a quick kind of rundown, obviously, up to the seventh dimension, and we can see as we proceed in the next hour if we can talk about the rest as well. But basically what you're saying, this is where the gates are open up to the seventh in that sense, and we have to, of course, begin to be aware of them, first of all, to understand that they're there, and then the components of that. So that's really interesting stuff, Barbara. But before we take a break right here, let's talk a little bit more about your basically how to get a hold of your material. We've been talking about Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, the Mayan Code as well, but obviously the latest book, Awakening the Planetary Mind, Beyond the Trauma of the Past to a New Era of Creativity. Tell us about the website and where to go on the site, Barbara, to pick up copies of your work.
Yeah, even though I'm not doing Astroflash at this point, my website still is up, and it will be. And so it's called handclow2012.com. And that puts people right over to a distributor that I work with. But also, everything's available on Amazon. Most of my books are translated into 7, 8, 9, 10 languages. I know that most of them are in Swedish and stuff. So people can find books in their own language as well as in English in the United States. And bookstores, they're pretty much around at bookstores.
All right, excellent. Handcloud2012.com. We will, of course, have the links up on the website. And do take a look at the latest book, Awakening the Planetary Mind. Excellent stuff and a fantastic rundown, if you will, on the whole idea of the catastrophic catastrophobia, basically the idea of what happened, how it happened, and some of the consequent issues that have been going on. And there's just so much more, of course, here, Barbara, that we haven't had time to talk to yet. I want to get into in the next hour a little bit more about the Fallen Angels, the Stargate conspiracy. There's lots of good stuff in there. So we'll save that to the next hour. So stay with us, Barbara, and we'll continue with more in a little bit.
We three, we're all alone, living in a memory. My echo, my shadow, and me. We three, we're not a crowd, we're not even company. My echo, my shadow, and me. What good is the moonlight, the silvery moonlight that shines above? I walk with my shadow, I talk with my echo, but where is the one I love? We three will wait for you, even till eternity. My echo, my shadow, and me.
We three, we're all alone. Seem like we're living in a memory. That's my echo, my shadow, and me. We three, we ain't no crowd. Fact is, we ain't even company. That's my echo, my shadow, and me. You know, I've been wondering, what good is the moonlight, that silvery moonlight that shines way, way up above? Yeah, I walk with my shadow, I talk with my echo, But where is that gal that I love?
We three will wait for you, even till eternity. My echo, my shadow, and me.
The second hour with Barbara is next up in our member section. She expands on the nine dimensions of consciousness and elaborates on the sixth dimension, as she feels that is where humanity is consciously heading. The sixth dimension is the place where thoughts change the collective. As a collective, Barbara says the desire for remembering who we are is becoming stronger. She also talks about the collective depression and creation of reality. Then we move on to talk about Neptune in Pisces. During the next 14 years, we can expect an explosion of mystical consciousness. Barbara talks about what that means and how we can use it. We'll briefly talk about what happened the last time we saw this transit in 1847. The hour ends on the topic of the Stargate conspiracy and the creation of a new religion. Fascinating material that you shouldn't miss. To listen to the next hour, subscribe to our member section. When you do, you'll get full access to all of our programs going back to 2006. The majority of what we produce is for free. The first hour is always free. Sometimes we make both hours available for free as well. It's with our member section that we ensure that we can continue to steadily produce material. At the same time, we spare you from commercial breaks, a website free of blinking banners, and a program that doesn't rely on a network to get the message out. In other words, we are completely free from central command censorship and other agendas, and we let the answers take us where they may. Continue to listen to Red Eyes Radio to hear Gerard Williams, Cole Levy, Dean Clifford, Carl Munk, James Gilliland, Laird Scranton, David Icke, Robert Schock, Håkan Blomqvist, Desiree, and J.J. Hurtak, and Mike Cross, to name a few. We welcome your guests and topic suggestions as well. Stay with us for more with Barbara Handcloud coming up.